Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us today. And it's a pleasure to welcome Johan Rockström. Johan Rockström is an internationally recognized scientist, a leader on global sustainability, founding director of the Stockholm Resilience Center, professor of water systems and global sustainability at Stockholm University. He has written several books and authored more than 100 research publications. He is the co-author, along with Matthias Klum, a well-known National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, co-author of a new book, Big World, Small Planet, Abundance Within Planetary Boundaries, Big World, Small Planet, by Johan Rockström and Matthias Klum. Johan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hopefully, we can all move past the idea of climate change denial at this point. It's real. I think we're starting to all realize that around the world. Perhaps the remaining question is, where is the tipping point?
Yes, you're right. And I think that's a very, well-founded starting point, that you're absolutely right. The scientific consensus around humans causing climate change is now so well established that there's no room any longer for denialism. There's always a certain spectrum of healthy skepticism, which is part of the scientific endeavor of improving our knowledge base, but denial is gone. Now, the big question is, exactly as you point out, where is then the tipping point? How far can we push the climate system before we end up in a situation where we cross tipping points? And we define tipping points very specifically, which is a point where you move from one situation where the Earth itself dampens and slows down change to a point beyond a tipping point where Earth takes over and self-reinforces change, basically taking over our role so far as causing climate change to self-reinforcing, for example, by releasing methane, becoming darker when ice melts, meaning that more energy is sucked up and less is reflected back to space, and basically ending up from a situation where our planet is our best friend to becoming a foe to development. So this is a very dire question. And when we embarked on defining planetary boundaries, we ask exactly that question. Beyond what point does science tell us that we reach situations of irreversible, abrupt changes that can take us away from a desired, stable, and resilient state of the planet? Now, a lot of science indicates today very clearly that once you go beyond 2 degrees Celsius, and even below that, the planetary boundary is set at 1.5 degrees Celsius, we risk these kind of tipping points that could self-reinforce us not to 2, but 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees Celsius. So to put it, simple, the planetary boundary is the point where you enter a zone of nonlinear, potential nonlinear change, and that is roughly at 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming compared to the pre-industrial level, and we've today reached 1. So we have very little left, and we need to very quickly bend the curves of emissions to stand a chance for a safe future on the planet.
Now, we think about planetary boundaries, but you gave many examples in the book, Big World, Small Planet, of how that actually might play out. One example being a lush rainforest with a certain amount of climate change and human intervention can very quickly change over into a dry savanna. And once it changes, it's very hard to turn it back into a rainforest.
Yes, you see, what happens is that, what is it that keeps a rainforest a rainforest? Well, it is that it has, self-reinforcing processes that keeps it in this desired state. So rainforest is a rainforest because it has tall trees with deep roots and very, very dense canopies, which means two things. One is that it maintains a very high degree of humidity. Everyone knows that walking in a rainforest, how damp and sweaty it is thanks to the high degree of humidity. And the second is that it has a vast canopy which releases vapor, and that it actually thereby creates its own rainfall by pumping up vapor into the atmosphere, which create clouds and sends back, you know, often over 50% of the rainfall coming from the evaporation it has created by itself. So rainforest has these feedbacks that keeps it stable in a desired state. Now, if you cut down trees and if you warm the climate, you open up the trees and you make things drier, which means that suddenly at a certain very, very specific biophysical point, the rainforest tips over abruptly from being, you know, able to self-reinforce and create rainfall to suddenly tip over and start self-drying and self-losing rainfall because it becomes so open and so dry and so warm that it loses that whole so-called feedback. And that is what we call a tipping point. And when that occurs, a rainforest can very abruptly shift over into becoming a savanna. And that is a dramatic change, which, of course, kills off biodiversity, loses a major, major carbon sink on the planet, which would then also give a negative feedback into global warming, but also loses our ability to generate rainfall. There's more and more science, for example, showing something very dramatic, that the Amazon rainforest is such a pump of fresh water that it not only self-generates its own rainfall, it even generates rainfall downwind, which fills up the reservoirs, which are very significant in delivering fresh water to big, big urban economic centers such as Sao Paulo, which is the heart of the Brazilian economy. Mm-hmm. So you can see how an ecosystem, the Amazon, has tipping points which could affect very abrupt shocks into the economy due to freshwater changes. And this is what we're seeing across the entire planet, be it climate change inducing ice melt, which could abruptly shift the color of the Greenland ice sheet from being white, you know, basically self-cooling itself. Ice sheets are like, you know, air conditioners for the planet. A white surface reflects back, and you and I know it, you know, you sit in a white car, it's much colder than a dark car in the summer. Sure. And that's how Greenland works. But if the ice melts, it becomes liquid and it becomes darker and absorbs more heat, so it self-warms the planet. This is a tipping point from self-cooling to self-warming. And not only is it a tipping point, I must say, this is biophysically a tipping point, but it's also socially a bit of a scientific nightmare that we end up in a situation where the planet goes from being our best friend, meaning it tries to dampen our stress caused by emission of greenhouse gases and the global warming it induces, to instead becoming a foe, which could self-reinforce change. So that is exactly what you're referring to when you take this example of a tipping point in the Amazon rainforest.
So this is also what you talk about in the book as planetary boundaries. And if indeed there are these ecological limits to our planet, and it seems as if there certainly are, then we have the challenge that this poses to our patterns of life and economic growth. You said the Earth is our great friend. Indeed, the Earth subsidizes economies. So are we killing the goose that lays the golden egg?
Yes, that's a very adequate and powerful way of putting it, because we know through vast scientific evidence that, yes, we have been able to generate, you know, incredible human wealth through unsustainable development, which is based on the planet subsidizing our own human well-being. So, for example, half of our emissions of greenhouse gases are absorbed in the oceans and on land. 90% of the heat caused by our emission of greenhouse gases causing warming is absorbed as heat in the oceans. And all of this is, so to say, hiding our debt under the carpet. And, you know, until recently, the Earth system, not only did it subsidize our economic growth and our human well-being by accepting us to, you know, be unsustainable, there was ample fish to be overfished in the oceans. There was ample trees to be over deforested in the forest. There was ample atmosphere to be, you know, filled up with greenhouse gases without any invoices coming back from the Earth system into the economy. Now we're seeing a change. We've come to a point where we have saturated the entire Earth system, and we're starting to see that, you know, the atmosphere, the oceans, the forests cannot cope with more of our pressure, and that this can lead to a very, very large payback time for humanity. So you're right that, you know, we have been lulled into this comfort zone that, you know, we are this small planet, we're this small world on a big planet. The planet can cope with our burden, while in reality, it's only the last 25 years that science shows that, you know, the laying of golden eggs period is over. Now we've reached a saturation point where we cannot have this free subsidy just continuing to simply give us wealth despite us not taking care of the planet. And now instead we have to transition into a fully sustainable pathway so that we avoid the grand invoices coming back to us, which is, you know, disastrous changes due to drought conditions related to climate change, that we get sea level rise that could even eradicate certain low-lying island state nations in the world, that we have abrupt sea ice changes which would, you know, shift even the climate patterns, which could be related to the fact that the jet stream from the Arctic is pushed further southwards, which could be related to the very recent dramatic snow blizzards in the east coast of the U.S. So, you know, we're taking huge risks.
Now, this is also happening at a time when the population of the world is expanding rapidly. We're soon going to have billions more people on this earth. Many of those people have not yet had economic development. Some have, and they don't want to give it up. The ones who haven't experienced yet would like to achieve it. That means energy. Energy we usually equate with even further pollution, which leads to even more of an environmental problem. Can we still have growth and still try to tackle these challenges?
No, that's a very good question. And to start with, you're absolutely right. We're 7.2 billion people today. We have to recognize, however painful it is, that it's the rich minority, roughly 1.5 to 2 billion, that has caused the bulk of the exponential rise in our pressures on the planet so far. And we're committed to 9, 10 billion people in the world over the next 35 years. Whether we like it or not, that is the reality. Now, we also know equally well that if you would plot GDP growth or economic growth on one axis and energy use on the other, it's a linear relationship. So everyone knows, and that's been the very, very sensitive part of the climate negotiations, that the only way we know to create good human well-being and good economic growth is through access to cheap modern energy. That is why many developing countries say, you know, oh, so the climate negotiations are unacceptable for us because you, the rich world, has caused the bulk of the climate change problems by emitting greenhouse gases. You have great human well-being thanks to cheap oil, coal, and natural gas. And now you're telling us, right when the party is coming, when we come to the party, that the party is over. And that is unacceptable. So this has been the big divide in the climate negotiations.
And hold on,
cheap energy, a key for well-being growth. That's right.
And hold on now, just one moment. We'll take a quick break. And we'll take a look at how we can address that problem, because it is a unique problem, but one that is going to have to be addressed. It's not just a matter of everybody getting an iPhone. It's a matter of things like transportation and food for an ever-growing population. It's an intriguing book and very well written, and by the way, some magnificent photographs throughout the book. Big World, Small Planet. We're speaking today with co-author Johan Rockström. More in just a moment. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our guest is Johan Rockström, co-author of a new book, Big World, Small Planet. Big World, Small Planet, Abundance Within Planetary Boundaries. And we were talking about the idea of continued growth without destroying the planet, essentially. What are some of those global transformations that we're going to have to see if we hope to have any chance of achieving growth and still cleaning up the planet?
Yes. So thanks for bringing this fundamental question up. And that is where, you know, despite the fact that there's never been scientific reason to be more concerned than today due to exponential rise in global environmental risks, there's a paradox, which is never before in my professional life has there been so much reason for hope, which is exactly what you're hinting at, that, you know, up until just 5-6 years back, there was still very strong evidence to say, yes, we have major global environmental risks, but we don't have a solution of how to deliver human well-being for a rapidly rising world population, while at the same time safeguarding, you know, a safe climate system, avoiding biodiversity loss, and saving fresh water. Now, today, that has changed. Today, we have ample evidence that we're not talking about limits to growth. We're talking rather about growth within limits, meaning growth within planetary boundaries, meaning setting science-based boundaries for a safe operating space for humanity, the biophysical boundaries within which we have a playing field that can enable us to continue in our safe, desired, what we call an Eden's Garden, stable state of the planet, which we today can define very clearly with the Holocene geological era that we've had since the last ice age, and that within this safe operating space, we have more and more evidence that we do have modern, renewable, clean energy technologies, from photovoltaics to wind power to hydro, biomass, and to some extent nuclear, that we can deliver modern energy systems, alleviate poverty, and have even better health and better prosperity with modern energy systems, which moreover today, despite the remarkably low oil prices, which are, you know, down to $30 per barrel today, can compete today with fossil fuel energy systems. So that changes the game entirely. We see more and more evidence that sustainable production of food that does not increase, you know, the use of fresh water, increase the pollution of waterways and our land areas, can deliver healthier food and moreover do it at a high productive level. Sustainable agriculture is no longer just a just kind of an utopian little esoteric sideline, but rather a potential main strategy. So I would say we've been shifting the whole argument that sustainability, which until recently was, you know, in corporations, a corporate social responsibility, essentially a moral, ethical engagement in protecting nature for the sake of nature as a moral obligation. Today, sustainability is at the heart of the boardroom. It's at the heart of the business models increasingly among CEOs at corporations. We see political leadership engaging in global sustainability in a way we haven't seen for many, many years through the climate agreement in Paris, seeing that, you know, solving the global climate risk is not only a necessity to avoid very costly risks, but also an opportunity to deliver a sustainable, modern, high-tech 21st century future. So,
yes,
you know, that shift is something which I think we need to today recognize as well.
A recognition that really the wealth of the world comes from the planet itself. This is an amazing book.
Yes, exactly.
A very well-written book. It explains the science in a way that is understandable, and then it also grabs your attention with some excellent charts and just some beautiful photography as well. Big World, Small Planet, and a Vital Topic. Big World, Small Planet by Matthias Klum and our guest today, Johan Rockström. Big World, Small Planet. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, and I appreciate being invited to the show.